Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Are you ready to begin?
Yes, I'm all set here.
Any program about science or scientists today is almost bound to focus on space.
Okay, Houston, the Challenger has landed.
Houston Station, we are ready for the event. Thank you.
Hello, it's Richard here with another Space Boffins, and can we just go round the room to check we're ready?
BC, go.
Kenny,
go.
BC,
go.
ATC-1,
go.
TTA,
go.
Field 1,
go.
Field 2,
go.
CAM-1,
go.
ATC-3,
go.
That's the checklist from last week's launch of the first Orion spacecraft. Sue Nelson was there reporting for Space Boffins, and more from her in a moment. I'll also be talking to the head of the UK Space Agency after Europe's science ministers agreed funding for the International Space Station, a new rocket, and a mission to Mars. Plus, we meet the maker of the space station's new coffee machine. With me, author and science journalist Stuart Clark and science broadcaster and TV presenter Sarah Cruddas. Sarah, excited about Orion? Was it exciting?
That launch was absolutely incredible. And I think the fact we had the whole of the day before, it didn't quite manage to go. And then it went bang on time at the start of the window on Friday. Just incredible. And I hope it will maybe inspire a new generation in the same way that Apollo did.
And Stuart, is that anticipation really helps, doesn't it, with space? That things don't quite go to plan and you're just sitting there on the edge of your seat.
Yes, it is like some kind of high-tech reality TV show, you know, that you literally are on the edge of your seat. And with social media, you can interact with everybody else through Twitter and things like that. So you can feel the excitement that's coming along with these launches.
Well, Sue travelled to Cape Canaveral to take part in a NASA social, which is a gathering organised by the agency for a selected group of space fans. They were given better access than the world's media to the emotional roller coaster of the first Orion launch. We join Sue on day one.
Well, about 15 minutes to go to the launch. I'm standing on the edge of a swamp. According to one of the social media people here today, there was an unexpected visitor on a recent launch.
They had an alligator come out of the water in front of where everyone was watching.
What happened?
I think everyone kept watching the thing. He left us alone.
So the launch was more important,
yes,
than
course.
Being bitten on
alligator
the
just wanted to watch. Better view.
My name is Megan Grothman, here for the NASA social event.
And where are you from, Megan?
From St. Louis, Missouri.
I'm Mac Bradley. I'm also from St. Louis, Missouri, but I didn't know her before yesterday. And I'm here to see something really amazing.
But aren't you a little bit of a bad luck charm?
In general terms, I'm a bad luck charm, yeah. But are you talking about this specifically? Yes. This will be my fourth attempt at watching a launch, and hopefully my first real one.
I can hear the wind on the microphone, actually. It is picking up a bit, so we might be waiting a little bit longer.
But it's okay, because we're all on internal power.
I am now. I've had a coffee.
And in fact, the wind and a rogue boat did indeed scrub the launch for 24 hours. But there were compensations. I saw the vehicle assembly building and also visited the booster fabrication facility. And it was there I met Brian Duffy, Vice President of ATK Aerospace Group, the company that builds and services NASA's solid rocket boosters. Brian is also an astronaut, having flown 4 shuttle missions, 2 as commander. And he was surrounded by multicolored booster parts.
The plan is for all of this hardware that you see here, and by the way, all of it has flown in the space before on the space shuttle program and been recovered and refurbished. It's all going to be used again in support of the Space Launch System program, which is the next heavy lift launch capability that NASA is developing.
And the one behind you that's slightly conical shaped,
yes.
They're all either green or a mustard yellow. This green one looks a bit battered more than most.
You know, that piece of hardware there is actually one that I flew into space with. And so on my last flight, that was one, it's called an aft skirt, and it's the part of the motor that attaches to the launch platform. So it's where the rocket is held in place until launch. And so that was one of the aft skirts that I flew back in the year 2000.
So as someone who's flown in the space shuttle, and now you're seeing the next generation of spacecraft, the SLS, the Space Launch System,
yes.
Do you see this as a progression, or as almost a sort of, it does hark back to the Apollo era when you know that it, you know, eventually the astronauts are going to come down with parachutes and splash down?
Yeah, we continue to build from one program to the next, and we've learned some things. Apollo, of course, went to the moon. That was their goal and came back. But we used a lot of the lessons learned from Apollo in the space shuttle program, where we assembled the International Space Station, and it's where we learned to live and work in space, which is going to be important if we're going longer distances in the future. So if we want to go to Mars someday, which we do, then we have a lot to learn, and we're in the process of learning that, and it's a stepwise process to do that.
So what for you is the most interesting aspect of Orion?
Having the ability for the U.S. to fly U.S. astronauts to space and into deep space. We haven't been beyond low Earth orbit since 1972. It's a long time. And we would like, Orion is the vehicle that will be able to carry people beyond low Earth orbit.
So hopefully this is the beginning of a new generation for NASA.
We'd like to think that the launch tomorrow is the first step to Mars.
To Mars. Would you like to go to Mars?
I would love to go to Mars. Do you want to know why?
I would love to know why.
It's the red planet. You got it? Because Elmo's red. Okay.
You would fit right in.
Elmo would love to. Elmo wants to be an astronaut when he grows up.
That was Sesame Street's Elmo talking to astronaut Ricky Arnold about the Orion launch at the Kennedy Space Center. Yes, I was there. And after another early night, it was time to drive to the NASA bus again.
Well, I've arrived. I'm back in the car park a couple of miles away from the Cape Canaveral entrance. Let's get outside into the car park. And there are already, even though it's 4:30 in the morning, the car park is half full. Full moon up ahead. How apt above Cape Canaveral. Lock the car. And I'm going to join all the other NASA social members who are outside the bus. And we're ready to do it all again. And fingers crossed, this time there'll actually be a launch. Okay, I've arrived at the site. We're just a tad closer this time. You can see the launch pad lit up. It's an amazing sight, actually, particularly because it's across the water. You see the waves lapping towards you, and as long as there's not an alligator coming up, I'll be happy. And I'm with one of the fellow NASA social team members. Introduce yourself and what you do, because you've got quite a cool job.
My name is Bobby Russell, and I run a nonprofit called Quest for Stars. And we go around to high schools and middle schools across the United States and bring high-altitude projects, science projects, to those schools. I'm also a pilot. I'm an aerobatic pilot with about 1,000 hours in flight. As well as I'm a suborbital spaceflight candidate and trainee.
Tell us about that, because you've bought a ticket.
Correct. I've had the good fortune of winning a space industry award for my nonprofit work, which gave me a 2-for-1 coupon on a company called X-Core, who has their Lynx suborbital rocket plane. So I've gone through the centrifuge and high altitude training already, and I'm awaiting the build out of the aircraft or the spacecraft so we can actually fly on it.
And how confident do you feel considering the recent accident at Mojave?
Well, it's funny you should bring that up, because I was actually on the flight line in Mojave on October 31st, 2014, this last October, when the breakup of the spacecraft occurred. And it was, the only way I could put it was like watching Challenger live. And I was standing next to the Scale Composite and Virgin Galactic folks who for quality assurance. So it was a bad day. But you realize through what I'm reaching for and what these team members are reaching for, it's a dangerous proposition, but it didn't faze me. I'm still ready to go, and I know they will get it right.
Go. AC. AC is go. RC. Clear to proceed. Launch director. This is the launch director. You have permission to launch.
Proceeding up the tower. MFU established, swing arm octane full.
Nine, oh, to the left.
Eight, seven, six.
Five, four, three, two, one. And liftoff at dawn. The dawn of Orion and a new era of American space.
Oh, wow, it's going up so slowly. Oh, my goodness. It's sort of hovering in the sky.
We could let that run on a little bit. Sue reporting from Cape Canaveral. Oh, the excitement! I was on the edge of my seat again.
Sue's
there.
Brilliant. You really felt like you were there with her.
Yeah, I really wish I was there with her.
Did you draw straws to decide who went?
No, she put the effort in to get onto the NASA social, and they did. They had amazing access. And these remarkable people, all these space fans and these space people from across the country, and just got so close to that launch as well.
I think it's a great thing that NASA are doing. So when I was there for Atlantis for the final shuttle launch, we were there as journalists, and then literally the other side of the press site, all the NASA SOSA team, they got to see all the access we do, the journalists, and they're tweeting it, and they're just reaching a new audience, which is...
If I was going to be sceptical about it or cynical about it, what it gives NASA is, on Twitter, for example,
free coverage.
Most of us were following this, the space fans dominate Twitter. So you get an overwhelmingly positive message on social media about the launch. I mean, there's no reason not to have a positive message, but actually that completely tranches all the traditional media on there. I mean, Stuart, do you find that you live tweeted, you live blogged the Rosetta landing, for example, on the comet?
Yes, and I did the same. I did the same for the Orion launch day as well. And it is extraordinary because there's so much. I mean, the tweet stream is just whizzing round, you know, like a fruit machine. You can't keep up with it, and. So the important thing, I think, as a journalist, to keep in the back of your mind is this a vocal minority, and to try and get to the bottom of what this program is truly about and whether it can truly achieve these stated aims.
Well, that's what I wanted to come on to, because you heard Rod Navius, the commentator on that launch there, talk about a new era of American space. Is it really?
It is, in the sense that they have to build, NASA has to build a new capsule to get their astronauts into space, because at the moment they're gambling on the private companies to build rockets to take astronauts to the International Space Station. So they're developing this much larger capsule with a much bigger deep space capacity. So it is a new era. Whether that's a good and a bold new era, or whether it's going to prove to be more faltering steps, depends on political will and, inevitably, money.
There is this issue, isn't there, Sarah, of the political will in America. NASA wants to do this stuff, and in fact the line completely from the Orion launch was stepping stone to Mars. They couldn't, I mean, you know, even Elmo talking about Mars, I mean, they couldn't say Mars often enough. But that's not funded, is it?
I just think the problem is Mars is such a long-term goal, and when we had Apollo happening in the 1960s, it was still a short-term goal. Yes, you had different governments during that period, but the whole country was behind it. You had small town America, places like Bell Aerospace, building these rockets, all working towards one goal. And I think the thing is with Mars is it's still long term. It's not going to happen within the next decade. I mean, you're looking at least the 2030s, and you've got to have the money behind it, you've got to have the political willingness, and you've got to get the people behind it. I hope it happens. It will happen. I think things will eventually happen. But whether it happens within our lifetime is still to be seen.
Do you worry, Stuart, that actually there isn't the momentum here to take this on? Because in looking at the timeline for this, I mean, this is fantastic. I don't want to give the wrong impression. But the first crewed mission, I think, is looking about 2020 or 21. The rocket, because the rocket we saw there is not crew rated, you couldn't put people on that. That's not going to be tested till 2018. So actually maintaining the momentum is going to be tricky.
I think it's going to be extremely tricky, and it comes down to money. So NASA say they need X amount of dollars to build this system, and they're told that they can have this much every year. It's about $3 billion a year, and for that they can build this rocket, this new rocket, the Space Launch System. They can build the full crew capsule and test it. And then that's it. That's where that's actually where they've got to. Finding a mission that this can then go on to do that doesn't need another huge amount of money, because you need more hardware to go to Mars. If you're going to go to the lunar surface, for example, again, you need more hardware. So are there missions that can be done with astronauts in sort of lunar orbit and things like that? It could be a very, very long time before we go to Mars.
So we need a vision, Sarah.
I think we do. I think the problem is we haven't got that same momentum. I mean, going to the moon has always been about politics. You look at China, they want to send a human to the moon within the decade. And it's about politics. It's about saying, look, we can do a big thing well. Come and join our country. And we haven't got that vision at the moment. We've more got an idea. And I think it was really interesting with the Orion mission, actually. They had ELMO involved, and they had a Tyrannosaurus Rex fossil on the actual craft which went into space. And yes, it's all a bit gimmicky, but it captures young people's imagination. I think that's one of the things NASA needs to do, is invest in the next generation, get them interested, get them behind it. Maybe with an asteroid. I mean, we don't know much about how many asteroids are out there that could potentially hit Earth, so maybe it's more likely we'll go to an asteroid and have people behind that instead of going back to the moon.
Well, we'll talk more about relative American and European funding as we go on. This is the Space Boffins podcast in partnership with the Naked Scientists. You can reach us on Twitter, Facebook, and on our blog at spaceboffins.com. You can also read my space column on BBC Future. Meanwhile, in Luxembourg,
we succeeded in raising altogether some 5.7 billion euros in order to assure the different ESA programs for the years to come. So the good news is that the future of the ESA programs is guaranteed.
A happy host of the European Space Agency ministerial meeting, Deputy Prime Minister of Luxembourg, Etienne Snyder, celebrating after science ministers from ESA member states agreed space priorities for the next few years. And, well, he's right to celebrate. Ministers pledged to build a new rocket, Ariane 6, backed Europe's Mars missions, and are supporting the International Space Station until at least 2017. What's perhaps more exciting from the perspective here in the UK is that Britain contributed £47 million to the 2018 ExoMars mission. And that means the rover will be built in the UK, and £49 million to the space station programme. Well, I suggested to the head of the UK Space Agency, David Parker, that even a few years ago, the idea of Britain backing human spaceflight would have been laughable.
We've come a long way in our thinking about all of our UK space policy, joining up the picture that goes from, you know, basic science through the commercial stuff into applications. And the involvement in the space station is a case in point, because we built a relationship with the research councils in the UK to exploit our participation in the programme for good science. But we're also going to deliver some really great technology onto the project, so communications terminal for the space station that will vastly improve the data downlink from the station.
And what will the contribution to the space station mean for the UK, both for the research community, but maybe for the future astronaut programmes, for example?
Well, it particularly means for the research community that they can lead proposals for experiments for the space station. That's part of the benefit of being fully part of the programme. It means that Tim Peake's mission is going to happen when we're still a full member of the space station programme, and it allows us to think about the options for the future. One of the other things that happened at the ministerial was a so-called resolution about the space station and exploration, which is not about the money, but about the sense of direction. And it has clearly says that there are three elements of our European exploration strategy: the ISS, the Moon, and Mars. And so it gives us the option to think about what comes next.
Does this suggest there might be an astronaut beyond Tim Peake with UK backing?
I think it's far too early to say. I mean, that's, I think, unlikely to happen in the next period, though I don't believe there's another selection process for astronauts. But, of course, it doesn't stop Tim Peake maybe having a second flight sometime in the future.
And what about the future of the International Space Station? I was slightly confused watching the press conference whether it had been funded to 2017 or funded to 2020. There seemed to be talk about it's going to continue to 2020 with European backing, but that wasn't entirely clear.
Strictly correct, what has been approved is the funding for the next 3 years. So most member states have put their money down for the next 3 years. The resolution calls for a continuation to 2020. In the particular case of the UK, we've made our contribution up to 2020.
It's all quite exciting, isn't it? I mean, are we at a point where you can say, well, the UK is a key player in this and Europe is really going places in space, particularly after Rosetta, where I think it caught a lot of people by surprise. It was a European mission.
Yeah, I think you're dead right. I mean, the Rosetta was a wonderful moment. Look, I worked on that project 20 years ago. I helped starting the early design of it. The propulsion system on board it is something I worked on way back then. So we all knew this was going to be a fantastic achievement. But I think also ESA did a brilliant job in explaining it to the general public. Look, with the tweets, Rosetta and Philae talking to each other, and the little movies they made, the animations, and then that spectacular kind of sci-fi film ambition they did. They've moved up the presentation of space missions to the 21st century. And I think that's took people by surprise, maybe, but why not? We're really good at this stuff.
And what about the UK in space? Certainly the next 12 months are looking pretty exciting.
The next 12 months are definitely going to be exciting. Obviously, we're a year away from the launch of Tim Peake on his six-month mission to the International Space Station. That will galvanise attention again on space activities. I hope on the research that he will do, and I hope on the technology. But I can think of many other exciting things. Look, the huge European Copernicus Earth Observation Programme, this whole fleet of satellites to monitor the environment and provide security in the event of disasters. We're going to see their data from those satellites starting to come down right into the UK Space Gateway in Harwell. Literally, there's a brand new antenna at the end of the road there. We've got the European Space Agency Centre in Harwell will open in June 2015. And so all our investments in commercial satcoms are going to go through that centre. We've got exciting projects, new, small, innovative telecom satellite project that's coming along. So, yes, it's going to be another busy and exciting year.
But the space station is definitely up there and definitely something that the UK is now embracing, even though when I spoke to one of your predecessors about 10 years ago, described it as an orbiting white elephant.
It's the biggest scientific laboratory project that the world has ever put together. Now that it's there, getting maximum value out of it makes economic sense, it makes scientific sense. It has to prove its value. Let's see the quality of the work that's done. So we're always cautiously sceptical, but we're open to the benefits.
A cautiously sceptical Director General of the UK Space Agency, David Parker. Now, I mean, Stuart, sceptics, even cautious sceptics might suggest that this thing has been built, other people have built it, other people have paid for it, other people have launched it, other people have got the thing working, and now Britain gets in at the last minute and gets the benefit. So is that fair?
if anything, it sounds like a pretty sensible thing to do, Reg. I think that the will to have been in there from the very beginning has always been here in this country, and it's been coming up against the brick wall of politics. Finally, that's been broken down because we've proved that the space sector can make a real difference to the UK economy and to people's lives. And we're, as David said, we're joining up that chain of events from the pure blue skies thinking and scientific research and seeing how that works all the way down into people's lives.
Sarah, do you feel that UK is very much part of a wider space exploration now rather than just a bit player?
I think the UK's always had a huge space programme. We've just never shouted about it. But all of a sudden, and especially with what happened with Rosetta, we're kind of, you know, we of course had the Ptolemy experiment, but we're really kind of waking up to the fact it's not just NASA and it's not just America who do these space projects. It's people across the world. And actually, the UK has a great space industry. It's going to be worth $20 billion a year by the year 2020, if I'm correct. And I think people just need to understand that it's not just about manned missions, it is about all the other things that we've been doing. So the small satellites, which we're of course leaders in with Surrey Space Satellites, and there's lots of great things going on with the UK.
I mean, Stuart, you did a huge amount of coverage, global coverage, on the Rosetta landing, or the Philae landing on the Comet. Did you sense in newsrooms suddenly editors waking up and thinking, oh, hang on, there's a European Space Agency?
Well, without question, it took off. And it started way back in January at Wake Up Rosetta Day. And I covered that again. And I can remember, I couldn't sleep that night. I was just so excited because I was just thinking about what had actually happened. This mission built in Europe, masterminded in Europe, had woken up and done all these things completely automatically on its own, found its position in space, found Earth, and sent a signal back saying, look, I'm here, I'm ready to work. And then we had the Philae landing, which was even better.
As Sarah says, it does show that it doesn't have to be human exploration necessarily that grabs people's imagination, gets people's attention.
No, absolutely not. You see, right from the very beginnings of the scientific revolution, with the first telescopes, the first microscopes, we've been used to technology extending our senses, and this is just exactly the same. The difference is that now we can access it directly and instantaneously on the internet. We can look at the comet through robotic eyes as if we are there.
What about the future of the International Space Station? It seems that there's pretty much an agreement from everyone now, Russia, America, Europe, to fund it until 2020. But not beyond that. And really, I mean, that's only 5 years away. What do you think is likely to happen?
I think we need to link this up with the first story that we were talking about, because the first astronauts that the first astronauts could be sent on an Orion mission is about 2021. And if you were to take all of the money that was being put into the International Space Station and then plough that into the extension of the Orion mission, then that's perhaps how you get back to the moon and onto Mars.
So you abandon the space station and go for Orion instead, rather than use the space station as a staging post or part of the Orion program.
Yes, absolutely, definitely. And I think if you were sensible about it, you'd sell off the space station. You'd sell it to private industry for scientific exploitation.
And Sarah, what do you think?
I think that's a really good idea, actually, selling it off. I just think it's a shame, though, if beyond 2020 people aren't using the International Space Station, because it's always feels like the case, certainly with manned exploration, that we go and we do something. So we go to the moon, then we stop, then we try something else and we stop, and we never really fully carry on. And surely you use the space station as a stepping stone to get back to the moon, to get to an asteroid, and keep it going. Don't just stop in the year 2020. It'll be interesting to see what happens, and obviously money is going to play a big part in that.
Well, let's stick with the space station and think of the worst deprivations astronauts face during 6 months in orbit. The cramped conditions, no showers, freeze-dried rations. Now, it is, of course, the lack of proper coffee. Well, in April, that is due to change. Space Boffin's regular Kate Arkless-Grey, who blogs as Space Kate, was at the recent International Astronautical Congress in Toronto. And there she spoke to David Arvino from Argotech, inventors of the Espresso machine.
There was something missing on the station. And what was really missing, right after also getting the information from different Italian astronauts, what they were very much missing was a real Italian espresso. So we started working on this machine some time ago, I can say a couple of years ago, on this project. And finally we found another partner, an important partner, that's Lavazza, because, you know, they are coffee makers, so they know very well their business. At the same time, together with the Italian Space Agency, we found the opportunity to having this technology demonstration payload flying on the station in April 2015. Was a really big project, let me say, because putting on orbit a machine that has to brew coffee in a safety environment, to bring a really good coffee, you require two parameters. So the temperature for coming out the coffee is 75 degrees, and the bars, so the pressure. And the pressure is roughly between five and eight bars. These are two major hazards for the station. So that's why, you know, this was, let me say, a simple project to bring coffee on the station, but it was very, very hard to make it working.
And what's so special about espresso? I mean, you can brew a normal cup of coffee on the space station. Why would it be technically difficult to make an espresso instead of a normal instant coffee?
Let me say that on the station there is no espresso, so you can only make an instant coffee, getting some water, pretty much all water, and putting inside a pouch, so inside a bag. This is something that they have on the station, but of course, making a different coffee, a different Italian flavor espresso coffee on the station would have been a totally different hazard, a totally different, you know, different thing for the astronauts. And I can tell you already, they very much appreciate it. I hope they will appreciate it also in the future whenever the machine will be on the station. Because I got a lot of different astronauts asking, hey, when is going to fly the machine?
So you, in the exhibition hall here, you actually have a model. Is that a fully working model? It's quite big.
Yeah, that's quite big. It's a 1:1 scale, so it's the same dimension. It's quite big. That's a good question. It is quite big because, of course, you know, as I told you before, if you have a pressure, fluids in pressure and temperature, this is a big hazard for the station. So we had all the systems that should have been redundant. So twice, just an example, pressure sensors, pressure switches, etc., thermal sensors, switches, that you have to put at least two, because in case one fails, you need to have another one working properly just to avoid having any hazard for safety reasons on the station. So that's why, and the other stuff, you know, having a home espresso coffee machine here on Earth is totally different, because whenever there is any spill of water, this spill of water, thanks to the gravity, will come down in a small box and everything will be collected there. This is almost impossible for the station, because otherwise, you know, the fluid will flow around and can also damage the system of the station. So that's why we hard worked on a system for avoiding that, preventing, you know, the spill of water.
David Arvino from Argotech speaking to Kate Arkless-Gray on the challenges of making decent coffee in space. Stuart was shaking his head sadly during that. Well, what bothers you about that, Stuart?
To be honest, I think it was one of the bravest pieces of journalism I've ever heard, because he actually asked an Italian whether there was
what's
any difference.
What's so special about espresso?
Extraordinary,
yes, I know.
I know. So, I love it. I love
it's
this story.
Effort. Yes.
I love it. The interesting thing is, I happened to be in Italy last week, and they haven't heard this story at all.
Really?
Not at all. And my other favourite fact about this space espresso machine is that it weighs 20 kilograms, and that is almost precisely the same amount of weight as the payload on Philae. All the science instruments weighed the same.
Anything for yes. coffee.
So yeah. land on a comet or make an espresso machine is what you're saying.
I think
okay.
we know which way that might
yeah.
go.
Surely when you're in space, you can't taste anything anyhow. Your taste buds
Maybe that's another reason, because you do need proper flavours,
yeah,
don't you?
Yeah, so the strength of it. Might...
So maybe the strength of it is proper coffee. But yeah, I mean, you know, Italian astronauts and instant coffee. I can quite see where they're coming from there. There's been a little bit of confusion about when this machine is being flown to the ISS. It's actually going to be flown, or due to be flown, in April 2015, and the aim is to have it working for astronaut Samantha Cristoforetti's birthday, which is on the 26th of April. Isn't that nice? I should get a birthday espresso. Luxuries in space question. If you had to take one luxury
to the International Space Station, let's say it can weigh around 20 kilos, what would you take, Stuart?
Oh, my guitar. Yeah, easy. The rest of the astronauts would hate me for it. But yeah.
I think there is actually a guitar up there at the moment. Yeah.
Is it an electric guitar?
No, it's almost certainly not an electric guitar.
Yes, yeah, it has to be electric.
Yeah, okay. Sarah?
Mine, I guess it'd be music again. Get some 80s tunes going on there, driving tunes.
It's funny you should say that. Because I was thinking it would be really cool would be a zero-gravity record player.
Ah,
a vinyl.
Yes.
So you could take vinyl. So I could take my 80s vinyl.
That would be amazing.
Collection. You'd have to and do some sort of bungee cord and spring arrangement to get a record
to spin
to
work. The whole thing.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, ideally, you'd really want one of those proper rotating space stations. Then you could play your records properly.
Like 2001.
Yeah, exactly. So, yes. You know, but I think, yeah, vinyl records in space. Any particular music you'd take?
Just, I think, everything from Prince to Journey, anything which, any power ballads, I think.
Power
quite
ballads.
Good.
Oh, Stuart's with you there, I think. Yeah.
We could do karaoke now.
Oh,
yeah.
Please.
And a camera, of course, to take even more pictures.
Okay, well, before we go, and what's fast becoming a regular dedication slot, I just want to mention Bill, who listens to Space Boffins during his LA commute, everyone who Sue met at the NASA social, and Michael has this question. Hi from Denver. I recently discovered the fun and informative podcast. That's us. I have a question about space planes. Both companies, in the short term, will offer straight up and down rides and not point-to-point travel. If one day point-to-point services are offered, is there any advantage of taking off from nearer the equator and travelling from west to east to use Earth's spin to reduce travel time? Stuart.
Oh, that comes straight to me, doesn't it?
You first.
Well, certainly there's an advantage for rockets taking off closer to the equator because of the centrifugal force that they get. So in that sense, then you would imagine that there's an advantage as well for space planes. But they're completely different because their lift is generated aerodynamically. And so that's a very sort of long-winded way of saying I don't know.
Sarah, any thoughts?
I would think surely going that way you would save on time because the Earth's spinning. But if you're in the equator, you're technically travelling a further distance. If you're further north on the Earth, it would surely be a distance to travel.
I think we need to throw this out to listeners as well, because actually I was thinking, because I can see where he's coming from, because he's thinking space plane goes up, Earth moves underneath, space plane comes down, so the Earth has effectively moved and helped the distance. But I'm not sure that actually works like that.
But you're going so fast as well, I don't think it's going to make...
And for not very long.
Yeah.
Okay. If you've got any thoughts, then do drop us a line on our Facebook page. Thank you very much to guests Stuart Clark and Sarah Credis for joining us.
You're very welcome.
The Space Boffins podcast is a Boffin Media production supported by the Atrium Space Insurance Consortium and ABSL Space Products. And I think we can all look forward to what's shaping up to be a very exciting 2015 in space. Thanks for listening.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.